Monday morning. Hope your day is off to a pretty good start so far. It is coming up to 10:06. Hi, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead on the show for you today. St. Mary's astrophysicist Rob Thacker settling in for an hour of Science Files coming up this morning. If you've got a question for us, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. And I'll make the introduction in just a moment. Next hour, it's your turn to sound off. We'll go to the phones for our first open hour of the week at 11 o'clock this morning. We call it Manic Monday. And as always, anything goes. And after the news at noon, Norm Collins with the Crosswalk Safety Society wants HRM to do more to improve pedestrian safety. He'll tell us what he thinks is needed. And we'll hear another Halifax History Moment this afternoon when historian and author Blair B. joins me. 10:07, but this hour it is time for Science Files. And joining me in the studio this morning, St. Mary's University astrophysicist, Dr. Rob Thacker. Dr. Rob, good morning to you.
And good morning to you.
And how are you doing this morning, sir?
Pretty good, pretty good. Just looking out the window here, there's not too many cars on the road, but that's probably a good thing. Pretty greasy and slippery out there.
Yeah, so you had a, you're okay driving, getting here to
the
station.
Yeah, no, I only had to drive up from SMU. I got in SMU fairly early, so to get some work done, and then I drove up, and there was only sort of like three or four cars on the road when I drove up here, so can't complain.
Yeah, indeed.
The usual young and roby turn was actually pretty straightforward for once.
If you're out and about this morning as the snow comes down and, again, rain in the forecast, freezing rain first and then rain, just to drive to conditions, please drive with some
care.
Be
careful out there.
Yep. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, give us a call and let's talk a bit more about the Lunar Gateway before things get
heated
up here. And the Prime Minister announcing last week that the government is committing $2.05 billion over 24 years to this Lunar Gateway, which is, in essence, a NASA project that will build an orbiting space station around the moon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting to see the government finally put its money where its mouth is.
So
the backstory to this is there's been a lot of criticism for, because literally probably about 15, 20 years, we haven't had a plan for Canada in space. This is called the long-term space plan. So a number of companies who would want to leverage off initial government investments to develop their own products as well at the end of the day have been complaining about this. And so there's been a big push over the last year or so, which I actually have to admit I was involved in going to the government and meeting with MPs and so on, various government departments.
That's your capacity as president of the Royal Astronomical Society.
Exactly. Yeah. So, we had some really good conversations, but I have to be honest and say that we weren't expecting the government to necessarily go in this direction. They had said that they were interested in projects that had Canadian leadership. And so in this particular case, you might say, well, it's a collaboration with the US and we do robotics in space really well. I mean, everyone knows Canadarm. 3 decades. Yep. That's what we do. So it's another one of those. That's probably not a fair way to put it, but it's a useful appendage on this upcoming Lunar Gateway. You could actually be a little bit skeptical of whether the Lunar Gateway is going to get built, because the whole thing was actually suggested in 2017, then cancelled. Now Trump has made getting to the moon a big thing, and so it's back on again. And who knows, if we had another government, what would happen?
Yeah.
But the key thing here is when we've talked about missions to Mars, we've talked 2030s. A space station around the moon, you know, the moon is literally like 2 or 3 days away. It's not that far compared to Mars. So this is kind of achievable, and we're talking about the mid-2020s, right? So this is something that could happen reasonably quickly. The one thing, and we can talk more about this because this is actually really cool stuff. The one thing that's really in question is what rocket is going to be used to take the stuff up there.
And why is this the issue here?
So this is really interesting, because for years and years and years, like, NASA essentially designed rockets. They had private contractors build them, but they were the ones who were really motivating all the design. Now along comes SpaceX, Blue Origin, you have Boeing as well. And now we have competition in the launch vehicle arena, while NASA, on the other hand, is developing its giant sort of like a true successor to Apollo, as it were, the Space Launch System.
Yeah.
And it hasn't even flown yet.
This is their heavy lift.
This is their heavy lift vehicle, and it hasn't even flown yet. So we have a situation where a number of commentators, I actually spoke to someone off the record on Friday about this, And he basically, he's quoting someone off the record, not saying who it was, but he was saying, well, you know, this is interesting because NASA really wants the Space Launch System to move ahead, but, you know, it's not clear what you're going to do with it. Is the Lunar Gateway the way of making sure this project gets finished? I don't know. It's really amazing. And of course, Elon Musk is now talking about his BFR rocket, the big Falcon rocket, if that's what you believe the F stands for. And so that actually is essentially like 1.5 Apollos, right? And they're moving ahead on this. They're going to be testing a little hopper version of it down probably in Brownsville in Texas and just sort of like lifting it up and putting it back down at the end of the year. They'll probably be doing that. And then you can expect them to gradually sort of like fly higher and higher and then move on to the real flight prototypes. And so that's moving forward as well, right? And so everyone is sort of like, who's in the area is looking at this and going, well, you know, they're kind of like completely jumping the technology gun on NASA. NASA is trying to do something we know we can do, whereas Musk and SpaceX are really trying to leap to a technology level that we haven't done before. And I know this is a really long monologue and I'll get to the point in the end, but the point in the end is that SpaceX are really ambitious. Sometimes they get slowed down in terms of what they're doing, but we're now looking at NASA being really quite conservative. Right. So what? Why is there so much difference? And the answer is because SpaceX hasn't flown people yet.
Yeah, they just SpaceX just flew a Dragon. They call it the
Crew Dragon, which was uncrewed. Yeah. Right. Initially, they put the Ripley biosensors and everything in there, or just general sensors to test what was happening and measure what would happen to astronauts as well. But the thing for SpaceX is they've been able to push forward with their technology development on the safety side because they're not flying humans. And so they had a really interesting idea of how they wanted to fuel the spacecraft. They wanted to fuel the spacecraft with the crew in the spacecraft, which is kind of dangerous because refueling potentially, there was sort of like examples of things blowing up in the 1950s. And so this has always been something that NASA hasn't liked, but they finally approved it. And so I'm sort of, you can be critical of SpaceX, you can be critical of Elon Musk and wonder where this is going to go. And full credit to them for what they've done. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens once they have a major issue with people and how their culture responds to that.
Got to read here. It says here SpaceX, the Crew Dragon capsule, they hope to start flying astronauts later this year.
Absolutely, yep. So there's a flight probably coming up in the summer when they will fly two astronauts. The Dragon crew can take up to 7 people.
Oh, okay.
Right? So you could think of it as a minibus.
Yeah.
And so they are going to be getting on the bandwagon of launching astronauts, so to speak. So it's going to be interesting to see how that goes. I mean, I'm curious to see. I mean, again, kudos to where they've got, but they've been able to get where they are by using a fairly sort of like, conservative is not the word because they're not conservative, but they haven't put themselves in sort of like high risk launches, which are the ones that involve humans. And now they're going there. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Well, they just docked on the weekend with the International Space Station. It'll stay there for 5 days. Then it writes, reading here, then comes a key test. This Friday, the capsule will bellow back through the Earth's atmosphere, deploy parachutes and land softly into the Atlantic Ocean. And the spacecraft will need to make a safe descent and hold up well during the water landing, or the manned flights are out of the question.
I mean, so Musk was visibly nervous ahead of this test launch because they wanted to make sure that was all going okay, and it did. So, I mean, to give credit to SpaceX, the launch stuff, they seem to do really very well. I don't remember. There was the one incident on the pad that they had. But anyway, so, it's a really interesting time.
Yeah, it certainly is. Yeah. And, again, the commercialization of space travel.
For sure. I mean, although I do think that's a little bit overplayed, because even when NASA was, like, peak NASA, 400,000 people, a lot of the stuff was still getting built by contractors. It was just really the sort of, like, intellectual design work and so on that was done within NASA, and now that's being farmed out as well.
He is Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files. Kathleen, stay there. We'll get to you in just a moment. It is right now 10:15 on this Monday morning. We'll be back with more Science Files with Dr. Thacker right after this quick break. 10:18 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker with us till 11. It's Science Files, and Kathleen's on the line. She's got a question for us this morning. Hi, Kathleen.
Good morning. How are you?
We are well. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you.
What's your question?
This has got nothing to do with space. It's just something I'm curious about. I heard on the news a couple of weeks ago that the North Pole was moving to Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's the Earth's gravitational pull. But Dr. Rao, can you tell me what exactly the North Pole is? How do we know where it is? Does
sure.
it consist of anything, or is it just a spot?
Okay, so this is related to what's called the drift of the magnetic North Pole. So there are really two things to think about here. First of all, there is the spin of the Earth, and that defines a sort of North and South Pole very naturally. Those are the two points that are basically static within that rotation, whereas everything else is going around. But then on top of that, we have the magnetic North Pole. And so the center of the Earth is actually moving around, and there's electrical charge in that. And as that electrical charge moves around, it creates a magnetic field very similar to the little bar magnets we all know and love. And so that's on a huge scale, though. And so that magnetic field comes out through the top and out through the bottom. And it's also coming out everywhere else. But the two sort of different poles, as it were, as we call them in the scientific literature. One is at the top in the North Pole, very close to it, and the other one is at the bottom, very close to the South Pole as well. And so what's happening is actually, it's not, believe it or not, related to the gravity of the Earth that's changing this. It's actually related to things in the center of the Earth that are actually creating this magnetic field, changing in ways that, if I'm completely honest, we don't fully understand the details of, because it's extremely difficult to get information about what's happening way down below the surface of the Earth. So we really don't have a lot of ideas. We have theories for what might be going on, but not the precise details. And so what's happening is there are small changes there, that it's always moving a little bit, but the recent motion is much bigger than we've seen in recent times. And people are wondering, will this be the prelude to potentially a flip of some kind? The short answer is we don't know, right? And we have more and more precise data as well that we're following on this. And so it's just drifting a little bit. If you are up in the North Pole region, it does sort of mean that if you're using a compass or whatever, then you need to be much more careful of what you're doing, right? But obviously up around there, you can probably use GPS or something
but
like that.
But is she right that the North Pole will actually is moving towards Russia and Siberia?
It's moved towards Siberia. I think it was something like 100 and something kilometers in that direction. It's not gone all the way there, but it's moved a little bit. I should probably be able to look that up and tell you.
Does that answer your question, Kathleen?
It did. Thank you very much. I just got to be careful about Santa this winter.
That's right.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye. That's very interesting. Let's see here. This is from Daryl. It says, Dr. Rob, are we getting a space force to fight aliens alongside Trump?
So I don't think Trump's space force was designed to fight aliens. I think that's designed to be wary of other countries trying to achieve. I mean, this is the thing. Maybe we should explain this, that one of the things that happened when the space race really got going in the 1940s and 50s, you're just a few years after the Second World War. And of course, everyone realizes that, you know, if you have military platforms in space, that's incredibly powerful because you can just throw things down at the Earth. You can put people in certain places very, very quickly. And so very, very quickly, the United Nations said, look, this is serious. If we have some kind of arms race in space, this is going to be bad for the Earth. So the UN quickly developed the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space Treaty as a way to make space about exploration and avoid it being this high castle for military exploitation.
Well, did the U.S. sign on to this treaty?
Yeah. Pretty much everyone did, including Russia as well. And that's one of the reasons why we've had so much. The cooperation that we see on this planet tends to be off the planet, right?
Yeah.
So you look at space stations and so on, and the U.S. and Russia, even in the height of the Cold War, they were doing Soyuz, Apollo connections and so on. And so that sort of highlights how space has been about peaceful uses. Okay, so coming back to today, Trump is looking at what's happening with people launching rockets from the surface, saying that this is an issue. Do we need to be able to protect our satellites? Wouldn't it be good to have a space force of people that we could put up there? I think, quite frankly, at the moment, it's a lot of hot air. I don't think it's particularly feasible or practical. The idea of having a bunch of astronauts fly off to something is really difficult. We don't have orbital rockets that can maneuver at that level at the moment. And so I think this is not terribly serious. And a lot of commentators are saying, does it even break the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space Treaty? So it's really questionable. And It's not for aliens from other planets anyway. It's maybe aliens from other countries, but no, seriously. And no, I don't think we'll be involved in this.
But with the U.S. and the Russians dropping out of nuclear arms deals and such, I mean, it's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say. I think a lot of this is, if you look at what happened with security of various nations going back into the sort of like Cold War in the 1980s, it was clear who, from our perspective, who the bad guys were. When you go to a situation where you have a number of different nation states who can do different things, then the dynamics get very different and it becomes, in some people's view, some security specialists' view, much more unstable. And there may be people who would like it to go back to there being the Americans versus the Russians. But I think things have moved on a long way. We're seeing nuclear proliferation. And so, yeah, I think from a security perspective, we are in a somewhat more scary place than we were 30 years ago.
Yeah, the doomsday clock sits at 2 minutes before midnight.
Yeah. Hmm.
Frank with an email question. He writes, in 2001, A Space Odyssey, the Jupiter mission ship used small nuclear explosions to get thrust. Would this be a gaseous core nuclear engine, he wonders. Do they exist in any form, or are they only fictional machines?
So I have to admit, I'm a huge fan of 2001.
Oh, okay.
That's one of my favorite science, if not, that is my favorite science fiction movie ever. Mm. So Discovery had a nuclear rocket. And so there's a number of possible different designs for nuclear rockets that people have considered. As far as I'm aware, NASA did do testing on nuclear rockets in the 50s and 60s. And the idea of what they would consider, I think, was something called a nuclear thermal rocket. And so in those cases, you're using a nuclear reactor to actually heat up the propellant and then basically exhaust it out of the back. So the reasons why rockets work is something called conservation of momentum, that things, if they're moving, they keep one moving. So if you have something that's still and you throw one thing out of the back, then the other bit that isn't being thrown out the back has to move forward. Right. And so that's how a rocket works, plain and simple. And we often talk about deflecting asteroids and literally just throwing things we've mined off the asteroid to deflect the rocket. It's same principle, to deflect the asteroid. So same idea. And so the concept for nuclear rockets has been around for quite some time. There are a number of different ones, but as far as I can remember, I could be wrong. I thought Discovery's was a nuclear thermal rocket, so that would have been something where you had nuclear reactors basically heating up the propellant, which could be something like hydrogen, liquid hydrogen, or something like that. I don't know. So and then just pushing it out the back. But there are alternatives. There was something considered by a fusion rocket where you were literally setting off small nuclear explosions out the back of the rocket. That was the Project Daedalus, which was developed by the British Interplanetary Society, probably 3 or 4 decades, by Alan Bond, who's a really great engineer, and he came up with this idea for the Skylon, this engine that switches from being a jet to being a rocket.
Okay.
And so anyway, so short answer, some research has been done, but there's nothing that's practical on those lines right now. And at the moment, I think we're looking towards ion rockets as perhaps the way forward, but it's certainly something that people have thought about seriously.
902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255, the numbers to call if you've got a question. For Dr. Rob Thacker here this morning on Science Files, we're going to take a break here in a moment. I just want to, Mark has just emailed us a couple of questions. I'll get to those after the after the news. But he did say he saw the February launch of SpaceX from Cape Canaveral in Florida live, called it very exciting.
Oh, I bet it was. Absolutely. I'd love to see a launch. I have to go and see a launch.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. That would be just, I've seen it all on television, of course, but to see it live would be great. And then another caller, another emailer wondering about the Canso spaceport. Maybe we'll get an update on that, too.
Yeah, sure.
All right, it is coming up to 10:28. We're going to take a quick break for a news update and more with Dr. Robin Science Files. We're back after the news and the news. Coming up down to 10:33 here on this snowy Monday morning at Science Files till 11 with Dr. Rob Thacker. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Your predecessor, Richard Zarowski, used to lament to this time of the year every year, Dr. Rob, the time change coming up this weekend. We go to daylight savings time.
This weekend. Good heavens.
I know.
Okay, it's really snuck up on us.
Spring ahead, and just wondering, any thoughts on Zarowski? Long professed to have Just one standard time all year long. Why change the clock?
I would honestly, I'd prefer to have that, quite frankly. I find this whole thing of changing the time. I mean, I know it's nice to have a little more time of like daylight in the summer, but at the end of the day, the animals don't care about it.
Yeah.
Right? So why should we do that? And I mean, there are sort of like fairly reasonable arguments that in fact there are a number of accidents that are caused by people being just really tired as the clocks go full.
Increased heart attacks.
Forward. I would prefer us not to do this. We'll see whether we do review this provincially, I guess, every once in a while. So at some point there must be another review of this coming up. And the other thing is it's becoming more of a hodgepodge across North America now, that some states in the US are doing it. I mean, obviously some provinces in Canada don't. Saskatchewan doesn't do it.
Some communities in British Columbia as well.
Yeah, so I wouldn't suggest we do it anymore. I think the days of really needing it have gone, and so I'd be happy for us to get rid of it, to be quite frank.
All right.
But Mark, I'm not going to make a big song and dance like Richard would, because it's just one of those things.
It is one of those things. Mark, with a couple of questions for us here this morning. One is, what was there or what was happening just before the Big Bang? We don't really know the answer to that. We have no idea.
Yeah. And the problem is that any information that would have existed before that time has basically been erased by the Big Bang anyway. So it's not even a question in some people's minds that we can even ask, because some people who view sort of like at the very beginning of the Big Bang, time undergoes the same kind of conceptual change that you have with the concept of north. That if you go to the North Pole, you can keep on saying, or North Magnetic Pole, you can keep on pointing your compass and saying, where is north? But when you get to the North Pole and you say, go north of north, you can't. And so maybe the Big Bang is like that, that when you say, how is time at the beginning, at the Big Bang, you can say, well, can we go back earlier? And it just doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Trying to put my head in.
Let's quit exploding.
Daryl writes, what about that space launch pad in Canso? Is this still a yes or no? Do we know? Will this be used in space launches? And as far as we know,
that is a good question.
Still basically status quo, right?
Right. So I have not heard anything since the no decision that happened last summer. And as far as I'm aware, and I could be wrong, if there's people out there who know more than me, I'd love to hear. There could be a situation related to dealing with hazardous events. Now, everyone got a little bit up in arms about the fact that there would be some rocket fuels there for the second stage of the rocket that are not the most pleasant things. I think it was hydrazine. And so it smells a bit like ammonia. It's not particularly nice stuff. There wouldn't have been a big supply of it. Let's make that clear. It's not the fuel for the whole rocket. It's just the fuel for the second stage, I believe. And so that's not great stuff. And I can see why people would want to be very, very careful about that and making sure that there was a proper protocol in place for what happens if there was an explosion on the launch pad, for example. How would the tanks be protected and so on? So I suspect, but I could be wrong, but I suspect this is all tied up in dealing or coming up with appropriate protocols. And then once those protocols are in place, then we'll probably see another review or a decision at least. At least that's what I would hope. I hope this doesn't go into a sort of like holding pattern forever, because we just aren't prepared to make a ruling. I mean, if the government and the people involved in the environmental assessment aren't happy with it, no problem. Let's see where it's deficient and see if those things can be fixed. But I don't like this kind of like holding pattern. So hopefully we will get some kind of yay or nay on this fairly soon.
10:37 is the time now. How listening to music significantly impairs creativity. This is a study out of the Science Daily. This sounds very interesting, because I would always assume that if you want to get
That's
creative.
That's not what you wanted to hear, was it?
No, not at all.
You want to sit there and go, da, 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 yeah, da, da, yeah. I'm that much more creative.
Explain.
So this is a little bit polemic, because I think that we've heard all of those stories about playing music to babies in the womb and things like that. Whether they're accurate or not is another thing altogether. So this was a very controlled study done by psychologists. Let me see if I can find where they were from. Okay, so from the University of Central Lancashire, University of Gävle in Sweden, and Lancaster University as well. So what they did a very simple test, and we can talk about why there might be a few issues with this. They gave people word games, right? And so they would give you three words, dress, dial, flower, and say, what's the word that connects the three of them?
Dress, style, flower.
Yeah.
What's the word that connects the three of them?
Right. Sun. It's okay.
All right.
I probably wouldn't have got it very quickly either. Mm. So you have to think about it. And so what they did was they then put the participants in different scenarios. One was where they had music that they were familiar with. One was where they had new music with lyrics that maybe they couldn't understand and all sorts of different things. And then the control was just like white noise that you get in a library and things like that. And it turns out that when you have the music on, you don't do as well as just the library background. Yeah. Mm. And so let's talk about that. And so I have a theory for why that is.
Why?
I'm sure
okay.
that they
let's
have
hear it.
Discussed this in the paper. I haven't had a chance to look at it. And I'm convinced that this is because when you're playing a word game like that and you have to think about it, and if you're not doing very well and then you're listening to music in the background, that sort of like distracts you, right? And so you're not going to be focusing as much as you would like to. And so it's a question of, are they really proving that music actually stops you from being creative, or are they really showing that music does tend to distract you? And I think of those two, the second is more likely, but I'm sure if I could find this paper and read more details, they do talk about that. But anyway, it's interesting to challenge this view, because I know a lot of people, certainly actually some of the students at St. Mary's will sit there with their headphones on like and listening to music. It makes me more creative. And it's like, well, actually, it may be distracting you.
Well, yeah, I like to write, and part of my routine, I guess, when I'm sitting in front of the keyboard is just music in the background. And sometimes I'll pause and just let the music sink in as my mind kind of looks at what's next on the, you know, that I'm going to write down. So I don't know, I guess.
So I can speak to this from my personal perspective. So when I was younger, when I was sort of 16, 17, I loved music and I would put headphones on, listen to music while I was working then. And as I got older, I really couldn't focus anymore with it on. So I stopped. And then I did actually find eventually I liked going to libraries, right? And working in libraries because they were quiet.
Quiet.
And here's the thing. A lot of students now say they don't like libraries because they're too quiet.
Is that right?
And they like a bit of noise around. I found that really interesting.
Well, we see the new library is more than just a place to read books now.
It's very much so. I mean, libraries, it's this kind of the joke here is the librarians are wondering where they should put the books now. Libraries are becoming connection places, resource places, places to work, places to be creative, and so on. They're not just about the books anymore.
Indeed. It's back to the phones, and Blaze is on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Blaze.
How you doing?
I'm doing
good
fine.
Morning.
How are you, sir?
Not too bad. I just got a question about the Russian hypersonic missile. I don't know if you know about it. But,
yeah, this is the new missile that the Russians say can reach North America in a flash and much quicker than we can respond to it.
Yeah, it's five times the speed of sound. I heard that how they do that is to create an air bubble in front of the missile. I just want to know if that's true or how are they – I know the States years ago was developing it, but they thought it was too dangerous to develop, and they squashed it. But just want to know if you know how it works.
All right. Appreciate that.
I'm going to be honest and say I haven't heard too much about it, but I can understand what the issue is. So the issue is at very high speeds, the friction from the air builds up, heats up surfaces, and literally you start to burn things up. That's one of the reasons why the Blackbird SR-71 spy aircraft, which went at Mach 3, was built from titanium. And so if they're suggesting they're creating a bubble in front of it, I presume the argument there is that that bubble is not actually moving and it's acting to deflect the air around it. I don't know how you would do that. Right?
There's some who are suggesting that the Russians didn't do it. It's all a fabrication.
Yeah, but so that strikes me as dubious. I mean, the way if you want to do something that's sort of like hypersonic is just to put it up higher in the atmosphere where the atmosphere is thinner, and that's the straightforward way to do it. I mean, you don't necessarily want to run something at lower level. And the short answer is, I'm not sure. That sounds entirely dubious to me, but maybe they have some kind of material on the nose cone, but you've got to get rid of all of that heat. That's the fundamental issue. The heat is building up, and you've got to get rid of it. So, yeah, I don't know. That seems I'm skeptical, but I'm not in a position where I can make any judgments about it without knowing more.
Yeah, and the Americans didn't appear to be greatly concerned about this, but only to announce that they're working on their own kind of hypersonic kind of rocket. But the Russians say that it can reach North America much sooner than even before the Americans have time to react.
Yeah, well, this is, I don't know. So if you talk to people who work in what's called control theory, one of the concerns with the Cold War towards the end was that the two systems, the early alert systems, were getting more and more tightly coupled. And so when you have very, very tightly coupled systems that don't have much time to react, if you have a false alarm, the damage of false alarms becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And so with something like this, once you start sort of suggesting, oh, yeah, we can get there and destroy you before you can respond, no, there are all of these submarines. You're never going to take those out. It's irrelevant. You're just creating a situation in which, yeah, you can strike first and that's it. You're both going to be toast at the end of the day.
Yeah, truly. 10:45 is our time. Pam, stay there. You're coming up. We've got Bob on hold as well. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with more right after this. 10:47 here on a Monday morning with Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files. And Pam's giving us a call with a question this morning. Morning, Pam.
Good morning, Rick.
How are you
morning,
today?
Oh, very good. And good morning, Dr. Thacker. I have a question for you. Just curious, how old do you think the Earth is?
Dr. Rob?
Okay, so as far as I recall, the Earth is around 4.5 billion years old, according to the various estimates that are around. It's a similar age, actually, to the Sun, because both the Earth and the Sun would have been forming around the same time. As the nebula that forms the Sun collapses down, so material that's forming planets usually collapses at similar times.
Yes. And just an idea, what would it, in the beginning maybe, what would the Earth look like? Would it just have trees and water?
Oh, I see.
Far from it. I think it was just mostly rock.
Right. So the way the Earth forms is you have basically what's essentially condensation, but it's the right word, but it gives you the wrong impression because you'll think water. But what happens is that rocks start to merge together and produce bigger and bigger rocks, which all merge together. And sooner or later, under their mutual gravity, they come together. And as they come together under their mutual gravity, they literally get squished together into a sphere, but it's very, very hot initially. There's things coming down and hitting it, like making craters on it basically all the time. So it's a really, really hot, off-gassing lots of water, and it's really a pretty unpleasant place to begin with. It's really kind of, I could say, hell on earth. To begin with. It's not very nice.
Lots of volcanic eruptions.
Volcanic activity as everything stabilizes and so on. And then over time, the heat comes out, right? But it's still going on. I mean, the center of the Earth is still very hot as well.
So just one more question. I don't want to keep you too long.
That's fine.
So what would the Earth need in order to sustain a species, whether it's human or whether it's animal? What components would it need? Like, it would need oxygen, right?
Yeah. So,
and it would need water.
Mm-hmm.
It would need sunlight, wouldn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. So, so that must have evolved over time.
So you've hit three key things right there, and I'll say of those three things, probably the most important one is sunlight. It's going to be a funny thing for you to hear me say, but in a funny kind of way, the world is nuclear powered, because the sun is nuclear powered, and that sunlight is, without it, basically we just freeze to death, basically. Mm. And so life depends upon sunlight to keep it going. Water seems to be a fundamental, incredibly useful thing for a solvent, for chemical reactions, probably had a lot to play in the eventual creation of the DNA molecule. And so oxygen, that's been incredibly important in terms of basically our whole biosphere and how different animals do different things within that biosphere as well. So all of those things are incredibly important to life in general, absolutely.
There you go, Pam.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. And a Fat Bob Rob Just, I love the name of some of these tweets. Says the previous caller in regards to the hypersonic missile. He says the previous caller was confusing the high-speed underwater rocket torpedo with the hypersonic missile. It is the torpedo that creates an air bubble in front of it to reach high speeds underwater.
Okay, sure.
Let's go back to the phones, and Bob's on the line. Morning, Bob.
Good morning, gentlemen.
How are you today, sir?
Well, I'm looking outside and going, yeah, that's nice, and I'm staying in.
Yeah. Good plan. Good plan.
Good plan, definitely.
What's your question this morning?
It was really interesting because you just, Doctor, you just mentioned nuclear power and of its existence and how important it is to the sun and how the universe was created.
Yep.
If you remember, I spoke about a friend of mine I went to school with that worked for NASA, and his specialty was radiation and nuclear.
Okay.
And unfortunately, he just passed away a few weeks ago, and I had an opportunity to talk to his sister. And his job was concerning the nuclear power or nuclear products that are out in space and the long range, that his job was to find out, and working with a rocket company in the States, I forget the name of it she mentioned, but that they were able to collect the nuclear sources in space and turn it into energy, which I guess you'd never need fuel. It would collect the fuel, turn it into the nuclear particles, and then that would be turned into energy that would rocket ships forever through space, because from what I can understand, that nuclear energy is already out there all over space. So I'll leave that question with you.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks,
so the only thing similar to that I've heard is the concept of what's called the nuclear ram rocket engine. This is also known as the Bussard ramjet, I think. Hmm. And so I'll be honest and say I've never heard of anyone suggesting collecting radiation and using that as a power source. There's something called cosmic rays, which is a form of radiation out there in space. And we're always concerned about that because it basically can impact astronauts quite significantly unless we have appropriate shielding for that. And so that's one of the things we really worry about on a mission to Mars. But so with the Bussard rocket, the idea there was that you would use the material that was in space, which would include some of the cosmic rays, and scoop that up and get energy from that, and then use that to power the vehicle using the rest mass energy of the things that you were collecting. But I haven't heard of someone sort of like, or an idea of actually collecting up radiation in space and using that as a power source. I don't necessarily know how you would do that off the top of my head, but that's not to say there isn't radiation out there, because there is, but it's the type of radiation that's really the key thing. It's not something you easily get energy out of, is the way to put it, I guess. The one thing that you can, the one type of radiation that does give you power really easy, is sunlight, right? And that you can convert into solar power using photovoltaic panels and so on. And so we do that already, obviously.
1054, and Alan emails to say he often sees the concept of time travel portrayed in fiction and in the speculative press. Mm-hmm. He says, this really annoys me. So he writes, what really is time anyway? And can we actually travel in time? My belief, he writes, is that time is not a location that can be traveled to and from. Time is just a measure of the rate of change of everything in the universe. We really don't travel in time. We just experience this change and measure that change relative to other known changes. Our brains just perceive this change as a linear movement, but that's only a perception. That's why, he writes, I think time travel is impossible. What do you think?
So you can argue, and this is, everyone's going to hate this, you can argue that we do time travel in the sense that we're always moving into the future, right? But moving into the past, there's no appreciable way of doing that other than in general relativity. There is a concept of a certain geometry that would connect the future to the past, and that's called a closed time-like curve. That's also related to wormholes as well. The reality of this is there is no known material that would allow us to do it. It probably violates all sorts of issues in terms of energy in the universe as well. So that's incredibly unlikely. Don't lose sleep over it. It's probably not happening. So the concept of time travel itself and all of the wonderful science fiction we've had come out of it is science fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no known way around all of the paradoxes you can dream up. I'll go back and I'll kill myself when I was a baby. So how did I get to be here? And so on. All of those things. Yep, absolutely. It is, unfortunately, a fiction. And don't lose sleep over it, though, because we're all traveling into the future.
Yeah, makes for great books and great movies.
Absolutely. That's about a lot of fun. Don't get me wrong. I mean, but you're right. It's just fiction.
And David just writes, time travel is a good literary device, but your emailer is right. And you're right, he says.
Yeah.
And on that note, Dr. Rob, and sorry I couldn't get to you, Bob and Tony, but Dr. Rob will be back with us again next Monday for another edition of Science Files. And
absolutely.
We covered a
always
lot of ground
a lot of fun.
Here,
but, great questions, as always. Always good when people ask me a question about something they want to know the details of that I can actually answer. And that's really fun.
Well, we look forward to you coming here each and every Monday. And Dr. Rob, see you next week.
Absolutely.
Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University. It is now coming up to 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We've got a news update for you coming up at the top of the hour, and then it's your turn to sound off this morning. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up between 11 and 12. We call it Manic Monday, and, well, as always, anything goes. And our phone lines await your calls now, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll take your calls after the news, and the news is coming up next.